ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You work hard, but would you put yourself in the category of workaholic? You might be surprised because it's tricky to spot when you're deep in it.
I felt like I was running constantly, that I could never get enough done, and that I couldn't complete. I felt like I never completed anything, although I was completing things, but that was the feeling, sort of emotional feeling, was that there was always more to do. I couldn't get enough done, and I was driven really by a lot of fear, which again, I didn't realize at the time.
I continued to work through contractions for several hours before I finally was like, okay, I think they're close enough together. I should probably do something about this. So I, you know, packed up, went to the hospital, and the very next day I pulled out my laptop and I continued to work. Yeah, I mean, just thinking back, my priorities were really off balance, obviously, at that point.
The thing was, I was running from myself, is how I see it now. I didn't want to feel anything. You know, I just kept busy.
So what do we do with our culture of overwork? And what does recovery look like?
It's tough because, yeah, if you need money, you have to work, but you have to work in moderation. And as is true for many things in life, moderation is difficult for many people.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. And for This Working Life, how to build a healthier relationship with work.
Hi, so my name is Melissa Clark, and I'm an associate professor of industrial organizational psychology at the University of Georgia.
Melissa is also a self-described workaholic and the author of a book called Never Not Working. You heard a bit of Melissa's story earlier. Here's what happened after she had the baby.
So I was in graduate school at the time, so getting my PhD, and that is like a full-time job. And it was in the middle of the semester. I was actually working on a midterm and trying to finish up the midterm. That was my work. And I didn't want to let people down. And I also felt this pressure to be an ideal student, almost like proving myself as a model graduate student by doing all this while having a child. You know, and I think they would have totally been accommodating, but I didn't even ask. I only took a week off from school, and I was also teaching my own class at the time. I only took a week off before I went back to teaching and taking my class. My mind was just a big blur because I had no sleep at the time. And, you know, I should have really prioritized my health and my relationship with my daughter. You know, it did have implications on, not to get too personal, but on breastfeeding. And so I do think the stress of all of that really impacted some of these critical parts of being a new mother, a first-time new mother. So, and I didn't share that in the book. That is something very personal that I just want to know how, you know, it really can affect not just your own health, but also literally the health of others that you're caring for.
When did you then realize and look back at that and say, actually, you know, that was a sign that it was too much, I'm a workaholic?
Well, funny enough, I actually stumbled upon the research in a class about a year later. So I was taking a class, and it was actually the start of that, of the meta-analysis that I conducted on workaholism, and dove into the literature and realized I was researching myself. I had all of these traits and characteristics, and so I was very drawn to it and have been researching it for the last 15 years. So luckily I was in a PhD program where I could study this topic, but I think without that, it would have taken me much longer to have that self-reflection. And even knowing this, I still felt like I overdid it in graduate school. And it really wasn't until, I would say, I had started my first full-time job after graduate school, and had more autonomy over my work schedule and realized I was burning the candle at both ends. I was just exhausted and not performing as well as I knew I could, and also felt like I was neglecting my kids, and they're the most important thing to me. And so at that point, I reshifted my priorities and I was like, I can be a great worker, but I can also be a great mom. And these things are both equally important to me.
Let's start by defining workaholism. Can you define it for us, please?
Sure. So most people just think of it as number of hours worked, but it's actually much more than that. I like to think of it as a compulsion to work that drives people to work excessively. So there's multiple aspects of that compulsion. You feel almost like an inner pressure to work, like I ought to be working all the time. I should be working. Even if there's not any external pressures, you still feel that way. And that causes a lot of anxiety or guilt. And you're thinking about work all the time. So it's not just physical work. It's also mental work as well. And of course, the behaviors. Workaholism does involve working more than is expected, having a hard time stopping. So all of those aspects combine are what we think of as workaholism.
And you're using workaholism, right? And so I'm interested to know whether you think it's on a par with something like alcoholism.
So it's really interesting that you ask that. There is actually an organization called Workaholics Anonymous, which is modeled after Alcoholics Anonymous. And so there are many parallels. It is not an addiction, though. So it's not in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. So it's not an addiction in that sense, although there are a lot of similarities. The aspects of addiction that come with workaholism or gambling addiction, those thoughts and behavior patterns are very similar to what workaholics struggle with.
And then what is the key difference between someone who works hard and a workaholic?
That's a great question. I am not against hard work. I'd like to say that, make that very clear. I think the big differentiation is, are you able to cut back when it's not necessary? So workaholics really struggle to stop, even when they don't have a busy time or their supervisor's not asking for something. It's just almost like an addiction to busyness, to always be doing something. And so I think that is one of the key differentiators. Working hard is necessary, but we shouldn't be working hard all the time.
Melissa says there are lots of reasons why people overwork. Some of them relate to our personalities and our upbringing, but others are structural and harder to control.
When someone has these workaholic tendencies, they treat everything as if it's a crisis. So everything is urgent. Everything requires us to work all hours to finish that project for the client. And so there's a lot of frantic leadership, I would say. One individual I spoke with called it frantic multitasking is how he felt that he was. And so there is a lot of short-term focus on the tasks and deadlines, but a lack of strategic planning because you're focused on the urgent situations in the moment. You can also put undue pressure on the people around you if you're overcommitting your unit and maybe overpromising to clients how quickly you can get them the materials. And that, unfortunately, then requires people to spend all night in the office finishing because you made these unrealistic promises. So there are a lot of issues with someone who has these workaholic tendencies and especially is a leader of others.
So there is a little assessment that you have in your book.
Yes.
And I did it, Melissa.
I am very curious to hear.
And I was quite interested. Okay, so it's out of 20. Mm-hmm. And I actually got a number 15 out of 20.
Ah,
Please explain.
Well, that definitely seems like you have some workaholic tendencies. What did you relate to the most as you were taking the assessment?
Well, there was a couple of things. First of all, I was surprised that I was still so high because I would also put myself in the category of recovering workaholic. So I was extreme. And so I actually gave myself a little pat on the back for coming down. I feel like my stats are going down though. So even though I might be 15,
would have been a 20.
Yeah, exactly. So I actually went, but this is me, I'm a bit of an optimist. I said, oh, 15, that's not so bad because I feel like the trend is going to go down. So
I like that way of thinking about it. You're making progress.
Thank you. I'm making progress.
Yes, continuous improvement.
That's right. So next time when we do this test, I could be, you know, a 10 out of 20. And I think the parts that keep me up is obviously, well, here's an example. I read your amazing book on workaholism on Saturday.
Yes. That is, you know, I think a good indication that maybe you should take more time on the weekends.
However, I do think that I put myself in that category of loving work, but I know that it is not a free ticket either. So I think for me, because I love my work so much, but I am aware of the deleterious effects on others. So, you know, just not being there for my family. So that's the work in progress part.
Yeah. Well, I think that's honestly one of the most important steps is just that self-reflection, because then you can only improve from there.
Yes, I'm aiming to get my score down to 10. You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National with me, Lisa Leong. This person we're calling Hazel is a reformed overworker. She sought help through Workaholics Anonymous and for a long time kept her condition hidden.
I didn't tell anyone at work because in the industry that I worked in, I think there's a lot of workaholics and workaholism, I think, in our culture and in a lot of industries is actually applauded, and people don't realise how dangerous and how awful it is, really. They just kind of go, great, they work really hard.
This is how Hazel manages her relationship with work now.
Under scheduling is one tool. That was one of the first things that I did because I was scheduled up to the eyeballs and didn't have, you know, a moment free and back-to-back appointments and meetings all the time. So under scheduling is one tool. So you leave space between things so that you're not running all the time. So that was one of the tools. Another one is bottom and top lines. So bottom lines are, I work no more than 40, 50 hours a week, whatever that might be. And then top line would be something that I'm working towards, which would be like my ideal would be to work no more than 40 hours a week. But my bottom line is I don't work more than this. So that can, and there's lots of things you can do with that's helpful. Things like sleep, you know, I'll get 8 hours sleep or I'll go to bed, you know, by 10 o'clock or whatever. Those things can really help. And there's also lots of other things I do. Yes, absolutely. Diet, meditation and creativity, being in nature and relationships with people, making sure that I put relationships with people rather than work as a first.
Work is much more manageable for Hazel these days.
You know, I feel so amazed and grateful that I'm able to work full time in quite a challenging role. And I'm still a workaholic. So I am invited into adrenaline and overscheduling and all of those things every day. And I get a lot of support. We have a daily plan of action so that it's actually realistic, because a lot of workaholics have a very distorted idea about what they can fit into a day. So my daily plan of action has everything in there, including, you know, lunch and a walk and a shower and, you know, instead of, well, okay, I'm going to work for 10 hours and I don't do anything else other than that. So, yeah, it's so different to how it used to be. And mostly I really enjoy working.
And here is Anne Maria, not her real name. It took her a while to realise she had a problem with work.
Was married and I was married to a workaholic. And I focused a lot on his workaholism. But then when we separated, I began to look at my own workaholism. And then I got the awareness that I was just as bad as he was. Mine was slightly different from his, but I was also a workaholic. I couldn't stop. You know, I couldn't stop being busy, being active, you know, even at home, at work, you know, it just was in my entire life. I just was active doing stuff. You know, if I was watching TV, the cat would never sit on my lap because I was up doing something in the ad breaks. You know, we had lots of ad breaks in those days. And, you know, it was like I was always multitasking. And the consequences of that was I'd drop things and break things. I'd hurt myself because I was doing too much at one time. I was an exercise addict as well. So I was running, I was swimming, I was going to the gym as well as working. And I had two jobs. I was cycling between my two jobs at lunchtime because I had one job in the morning and one job in the afternoon. And then I would go to the gym or the pool or something after work, but then I would do stuff in the evenings as well. You know, I didn't really stop. And I used to go to bed, but I would not have quality sleep. And I remember once going to the doctor and he described my sleep as non-restorative because it felt like the whole day, like I'd fall asleep, I'd kind of go unconscious virtually because I was so tired. And then I'd wake up in the wee hours of the morning and my mind would be just racing, processing the day because I'd been so busy all day. I hadn't given myself a time to kind of process what was happening in my day. And then I'd fall back asleep again because I was so tired, but I'd wake up just feeling tired, you know, just feeling not like I'd been restored at all.
After getting help, Anne Maria had a big realisation that helped her change her work habits.
The thing was, I was running from myself, is how I see it now. I was running from my, I didn't want to feel anything. I felt like I was kind of frozen inside or I was concrete inside. You know, it was just, didn't want to feel anything. You know, I just kept busy. So I didn't feel, didn't want to deal with stuff in my life. These days I can feel feelings. I don't have so much fear. I can, you know, be with myself. I can be on my own. I can sit and do nothing, which has been huge, you know, for years. I couldn't do nothing. Oh, my God. That would be dreadful, the idea of doing nothing. And now I can sit out on my deck and just watch the birds and the trees and look at the sky and do stuff like that and not panic and think, oh, my God, I need to be moving. And I don't run like an idiot now. I just quietly walk the dog and I stop when she needs to pee. I had a dog previously and I used to drag it along, you know, and let it stop and sniff and pee. And that's recovery for me.
But you don't have to identify as a workaholic or do a 12-step program to deal with your tendency to overwork. Audrey McGibbon is an occupational and coaching psychologist who specialises in executive wellbeing. Audrey says getting help and support from others is key.
Well, I think the first thing that they could do is consider who are they prepared to enlist the help of, because workaholism, if we use the analogy to an addiction, like an addiction, the best form of treatment is abstinence, and yet, you know, there'd be only a very tiny percentage in the world who could afford to abstain from work. So the number one treatment plan, if you like, isn't available. So then we need to put scaffolding around them and help them regulate and then create the support mechanisms around them. And that might be your partner at home, people about you putting in guardrails. In the workplace, it's harder. The thing that I think is sad is that in the workplace where people can spot it in colleagues, so it's easier to see it in someone else than it is to see it in yourself. And yet, for whatever reason, people tend not to address that or express their concern about it, other than in maybe a jokey way about, oh, you know, see you burning the midnight oil again. But it's not really something that gets an intervention that's staged. And I think for some people that actually really would be helpful. So in other words, being sent home having some supervision around enough's enough.
Then looking back on this idea of if the individual needs to look at their own behaviour and manage themselves, have you got an example of a really good tool or a framework or a thing you can do just to help yourself get away from your workaholic tendencies?
Well, the most practical thing would be to have something else in your life that you really love doing. So it's a lot easier to psychologically detach from something that you're quite dependent upon when there is something else that has you really smitten. But of course, for a true work addict, they probably have become pretty monodimensional. So if they did ever once have other interests and hobbies and things that they were into, they've probably gone a long time ago. So you might try and rekindle that. And I've actually had a success recently with an individual who recalled just how much they loved fishing. And it had been a big part of their life all the way through until they had become a very senior, successful executive. And their work patterns were definitely unhealthy and manifesting lots of the work addiction tendencies. And so, which sort of established a different type of craving, a craving for something that's constructive and healthy, and fishing seemed pretty good. And the next practical thing after having identified something is then really just committing to a boundary, putting some limits and constraints onto your work, and don't go for, you know, something unrealistically stressful. It can be working with people who would get on average maybe 3 hours of sleep a night. You're not going to say to that individual, right, well, you know, into bed by 10 and up at 6 and go for a walk and, you know, play with the dog. It's just not realistic. They're not going to be able to get there that fast. So you would start, it's almost like a desensitization program. You'd start just by reclaiming maybe even 20 minutes, get them used to that, and you gradually wind it back. But it's about having those boundaries and commitments that are explicit, and then the people around about you to help them.
Melissa Clark has discovered some recovery strategies that work for her.
It's not a one-size-fits-all in terms of how people disengage from work and what works for them. Some people, for example, mindfulness might be a really good strategy to take their mind off work and to focus on being in the moment and being present. Some people, like myself, really struggle with mindfulness. I'm not going to lie. It's something that I'm continually trying, but it's not, it doesn't work so well for me, even though it's very effective for others. But for me, there's another recovery strategy that I just love. So there's a researcher by the name of Sabine Sonnentag who talks about different recovery strategies. And one of them, engaging in a mastery experience, I think is particularly helpful for people like me that always feel like they have to be doing something. And so a mastery experience is something that challenges you, really makes you think and concentrate on something, but it's non-work related. So this could be like learning a new language or teaching yourself to play guitar or the piano, something that takes mental energy. But because it's not work, it actually functions the same and it really targets the same areas for rest and recovery than things like mindfulness or relaxation. So I would say try and see what works best for you, because just because you're not good at mindfulness doesn't mean you can't find a different way to recover from work.
Mastery. Okay, I'll keep on working on my watercolors then. Thanks to Melissa Clark, Associate Professor at the University of Georgia and the author of Never Not Working. Thanks also to psychologist and executive wellbeing specialist Audrey McGibbon, and for sharing their stories, Anne Maria and Hazel. If you're willing to tell us about your strategies for managing a tendency to overwork, write me an email. It's thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. And thanks for all of your emails requesting a copy of the Team Charter for our Managing Hybrid Work episode. We hope it's useful. I'm Lisa Leong, and this episode was produced by Sam Wicks and Michelle Weeks. It was mixed by Brendan O'Neill on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naam, Melbourne. Until next time, it's okay to love your work, just don't work too hard.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.